You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the mother of all podcasts, hosted by Brian the Kid Callen and, well, none other than Hunter Big Brain Motz. Our esteemed guest, professor of law at Vanderbilt University, Ganesh Sitaraman. Professor Ganesh Sitaraman, that's the way I pronounce it. Now, the professor may have a different way of saying his name, and I don't care, because I'm right. The Counterinsurgents Constitution, Law in the Age of Small Wars, is the book we're going to talk about. And, professor, give me how do you say your first name again?
It's Ganesh.
Well, that's what
Sitaraman.
I said. That's what I said. Ganesh.
Exactly.
So if it's Ganesh, then why in the world don't you have it spelled G apostrophe N A A Y A S H? He has to be confusing to me and spell it G A N.
I think Brian just gave the Dothraki spelling of your name.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I think you know. hundreds of years, millions of Hindus might have trouble with the new spelling.
What do they know, dude? What do they know? Love this book, and I love your idea. We've had, you know, we were talking before we were on air here. We've had John Nagle, who wrote the Counterinsurgency Manual for the Marines and the Army, and in your book, you argue for the importance of rule of law when waging a counterinsurgency. You use the word law and rule of law a great deal. And one of the things that resonated with me was that we've had, you know, whether it was William Bernstein, we had Howard Buffett's son on, who was talking about, he's got $7 billion and he's trying to make the world a better place. And one of the things that he said, and Bernstein, of course, talks about in his The Birth of Plenty, you know, that rule of law is so crucial to any kind of prosperity, any kind of stability, any kind of innovation, movement in a society. But, you know, Howard G. Buffett, who is Warren Buffett's son, said, look, you can have $7 billion and try to make the world a better place, and you can work on farming practices and all kinds of expertise. If you don't have rule of law in these societies and property rights, which is really what falls under, I think, the banner of rule of law, if you don't have rule of law, almost nothing else matters and nothing else is going to work. And so I thought this resonated with me, your idea that we should use lawyers in the war effort in establishing institutions in our counterinsurgency so that when the war is finally over, we now have a system of laws and a system of institutions that are governed by rule of law that we can fall back on. And I'm sorry to do this long introduction, but let me just, I want to talk about the other sort of idea that is attached to that, which is that really resonated with me, which was the idea that, okay, we got counterinsurgents. Those are the bad guys. If we can just kill those bad guys or capture those bad guys, it's going to get better. And what you argue for very intelligently is, look, one side's insurgent is another side's freedom fighters. They switch sides. We don't know who the good guys are very often. Look at Syria. It's about setting up institutions and a social structure that either renders that insurgency obsolete, impotent, or included. And I hope I did a good job at least of talking about the main ideas, and I'm sure you're going to add to that.
But, yeah, you've really hit the nail on the head in
no
terms
kidding.
Of the
no
broad
kidding.
In terms of the broad theme. I mean, this right. is why why you do these, because you get right to the heart of the point. And and that is that there is a relationship between institutions and stability, legitimacy, and workable societies. And this is what people, when they say you need rule of law, you know, at a deep level, this is what they're getting at. And we think about, you know, we think about what makes a society legitimate, what makes a government legitimate. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is how there's different kinds of legitimacy. And I identify two of them in the book. The first is what I call an action can be legally legitimate. And that means it follows the procedures of the legal system. And the reason why we think that action is legitimate, the reason why we follow it, even if we disagree with the outcome, is because we believe the process was fair and was reasonable.
Okay, but now, let's dilate a little bit for a second on the idea of what that means and what legal means, because legal, the context, the concept has different definitions depending on where you are. So if you're in Afghanistan, the tribal jirga, Sharia law, for God's sake, in Nigeria might be very different, legally speaking, than what we would consider to be legal.
That's right. And that gets to the second part of legitimacy, which is what I call sociological legitimacy. And this is something that people in a certain community believe. And so the legitimacy of the legal system, the process, depends in part on the sociological legitimacy of the process as a whole. So in the United States, we believe in our system of constitutional rights and so on, and that is what we recognize and we believe to be legitimate. We believe that as a matter of our values. We think that's a great process. In other parts of the world, for hundreds of years, thousands of years maybe, they've followed processes like shuras and jirgas, and in the eyes of people in those communities, that kind of process might be the appropriate, legitimate, values-based process that they believe best governs their society. And so the process can be legitimate because you believe it, but ultimately it relies on this kind of deep sociological belief. And the reason why I said you really hit it on the head is, you know, for this to work in any of these contexts, it's got to be dependent on the people locally and what people actually believe, the kind of institutions they can build. And one of the challenges we face as the United States, one of the challenges any group faces as an occupier or as an invader or intervening, is that you don't know necessarily everything about the local community. And you can't impose things from the outside that have no connection to local society and expect them to take root and flourish. You have to have a kind of organic approach in which you build the rule of law, you build institutions from the bottom up. And that means recognizing things like politics, religion, ethnicity, traditions, history. And if you ignore things like that, these kind of ground up realities, you're going to be in for a world of trouble when your, you know, hopeful systems fail.
And so much of the, I think, why we don't even think about legitimacy in the United States is because it's obvious to us that we are the good guys. So why you would even bother supporting somebody else makes no sense. And you know, I mean, I think that's the thing is that legitimacy isn't even a thing that we've, you know, as average citizens, really sort of questioned and reflected on.
Well, also, though, I mean, first of all, when I hear you talk about how multi-layered the issues are, I go, well, first, the lesson number one, don't go into other countries and try to nation build. Because, by the way, you might be getting into a culture that doesn't actually even believe in the rule of law.
No, but everybody believes in the rule of law. It depends on what that is.
Yeah.
I mean, Brian, if I may, off air beforehand, you were saying, like, I don't even understand why anybody would support the Taliban, right? Why would anybody think
that
they
were... Well, I don't see what they're offering.
Well, exactly. And I think that's what I'm saying is, as Americans, we don't see what a bunch of religious fundamentalists are offering in terms of rule of law, but we don't understand that because these people actually do believe in Sharia, that might seem like a very legitimate alternative.
I see. Yeah.
Well, in some places that might be right, but I don't also want to give the Taliban too much credit or the people too little credit. One of the things that you see in places like Afghanistan is people support whoever can provide basic stability and security. And if it's the case that locally you have somebody who's willing to provide rule of law, criminal justice, civil justice, a way to, if you have a dispute with your neighbor about whose land something is, there's someone who can do conflict resolution, and they do it in a predictable, stable way that then can be enforced. People often will support that because if the alternative is total chaos, that is substantially worse.
Yes.
Well, there's the old saying that's often attributed to the Arabs, you know, that 1,000 years of tyranny is better than 1 day of anarchy.
I don't agree with that, but yeah.
Well, I mean, you know.
Either would Michael Malice, Hunter, you monarch, you monarch sympathizer.
I'm sorry, I'm not enough of an anarcho-capitalist for you.
Sorry, yeah, sorry about the monarch sympathizer we have over here.
Says the man who professor. Always wants to be emperor.
Well, because I would be a benevolent emperor, and I'm smart. Ganesh, I mean, I just said it. Go on, sir. Ganesh.
I think you just lost his support. You just delegitimated yourself.
Well, I just called him a god, for God's
sake.
That's a forgivable mistake.
Okay.
The great god Ganesh.
But even I mean, that's so much of, I mean, what John Nagle was saying about the Sunni awakening, you know, the Al-Qaeda delegitimated themselves by essentially trying to bully the people and kill a bunch of people of the tribal leaders who weren't supporting them. So, I mean, in terms of, to your point, that it's not necessarily that these people unthinkingly support Sharia, you know, they're smart and they're looking at, oh, this person can provide conflict resolution. They can provide basic human services. Don't know that I'm totally on board with this.
Isn't that sort of what ISIS is doing in a lot of these towns and why they have so much Sunni support, Ganesh, Professor?
So this is the, I shouldn't, you know, not being privy to whatever CIA classified briefings or whatnot on what's going on the ground in ISIS.
I think
at least from the reporting, you know, it seems like it wouldn't be unreasonable to think of ISIS as something of an insurgent group that is trying to build a state. I mean, their goal is to build the Islamic State. They call themselves that. And like other insurgent groups, the way they try to do this is by providing security, by finding ways to get economic resources, and then use that to control a territory. And as part of controlling that territory, they have to provide all the goods and services that people associate with governments.
Isn't that what the Taliban
tries to do this? Hezbollah tries to do it. A lot of organizations try to do it.
Well, wasn't the Viet Cong pretty good at doing that?
They try to do it as well. And the issue is in when you're facing an insurgency, who's going to be able to provide those resources? And in areas where someone is providing it, people, even if they might oppose the ideology, may be willing to go along, because to fight back might mean imprisonment, certain death, or any number of other kind of horrible things.
Okay, but you know, one of the things that I went to Afghanistan for 11 days just to do some stand-up. I'm by no means know really what was going on. But one of the things I did see and I have read is that the U.S. Army spent a great deal of time building hospitals, orphanages, schools. I mean, there was a real effort by the Americans to, implement a great deal of the things you talk about in the book, including working with Jirgas and stuff. And where did we go wrong, and how can we do it differently next time? What was it that we started this process too late in 2007 when we should have done it in 2001, or what was it?
So I think there's a lot of components to that. What happened, and what can we think about doing in the future? So in terms of what happened, I think one story is that we came to some of it potentially too late. So after 9/11 and the early invasion of Afghanistan, we moved a lot of our resources and efforts toward Iraq in 2003. And then Afghanistan got comparatively, I think, less attention than many of the people who were focused on Afghanistan would have liked for it to get in terms of these efforts. By the time it was 2009, 2010, when General McChrystal had taken over as commanding general in Afghanistan and really reinvigorated under President Obama the sense of the efforts in Afghanistan, it had been quite a long time, and there had been a resurgence in the Taliban's power, particularly in southern Afghanistan. I think that time scale creates a problem. The second thing that's a problem is in thinking about when we engaged with different sectors, the engagement with Shuras, Jirgas, the kind of informal or traditional dispute resolution systems, at least by my reading of the history, came later, came kind of in the late 2000s, not in the early or mid 2000s.
Yes,
I think that was too late. And similarly, the focus on
it was definitely a learning process.
But the focus on civil justice also, not just criminal justice issues, but the land and water disputes kinds of things, which are very important for people in kind of stability around their economic lives and daily life, that also came too late.
So
there's a variety of things here that came a little too late. But now, in terms of what can we do in the future, one question, I think you asked it correctly, is do we really in the first place want to engage in the kind of big nation-building types of counterinsurgency efforts?
Or is it even possible? Is it even possible?
Yeah. I think those are live questions, and that's a debate we need to have as a public, as scholars, as people in the community. But the second question is, are there lots of ways we can help and engage that are much smaller? And actually, earlier this year, the U.S. Army released a new edition of the Counterinsurgency Field Manual, and the famous one, the one that John Nagel worked on, that General Petraeus worked on, they revised that, they updated it, it's the sequel. The sequel is actually quite different than the original because it focuses a lot more on the different tools in the toolbox, and it says maybe we don't only need to focus on the kind of big nation-building version that counterinsurgency has come to mean, but we should focus on diplomacy, we should focus on political operations, we can partner indirectly with other countries well in advance of a full-blown insurgency and try to help them deal with it themselves before mm-hmm. we have to get involved. Mm-hmm. And so they go through a number of these indirect strategies, they call it the indirect approach, to addressing insurgencies before they require the kind of big footprint, nation-building style response. And I think that is a promising thing we need to think about in the future.
But the thing is, you know, I heard one of the things I'm impressed with about our military is that we do learn from our mistakes. At least we definitely have. It seems that in the War College and people like Nagel, I mean, they are talking about this stuff, I'm sure, all the time because they want to solve these problems. They don't want to run into the same problem they did when they have to fight the next war. The thing is, though, that I heard a lot of these concepts being talked about. I mean, I remember Bush saying before 9/11, Bush said, well, I don't think we should be going into other countries and telling them how to live their lives. I remember nation building being a bad word, two words. I mean, I remember people saying, and in fact, I remember Rumsfeld saying, we didn't want to go in with a huge footprint. We didn't want to go in with all those soldiers, even though the military, if you read Fiasco, the military was asking for way more soldiers. And and the people like, you know, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and whoever it was, we're saying, look, we don't want to go in with this overwhelming force because it would be culturally oppressive and insensitive
but
and
Brian,
all that.
I mean, listen, and this gets into a question of motives, yeah. But that's something that politicians have said for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years.
But that's what I'm saying is that you could go back and say who said what. And I'm just saying that I heard a lot of these. I don't know that a lot of these concepts were necessarily not talked about or lost on policymakers.
I think these concepts were. There's a difference between, you know, the United States has always swung between interventionism and isolationism,
yeah.
which is the spectrum that it seems like people were talking about. What, you know, if you believe Nagel's reading, and I do, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of counterinsurgency was mm-hmm. something that did not exist in the Pentagon in Vietnam, and it did not exist in the Pentagon really until in any serious way until 2007.
You mean the debate? Is that true, Professor, from what you've seen?
I think in the sense that Nagel and Petraeus and others pose it, I think that's about right. You know, the lesson from Vietnam famously was to try to never fight another war like Vietnam and to build a military that wouldn't fight those kinds of wars. It was a military that would fight Desert Storm kinds of wars, the first Iraq war.
Mm.
And then you come back and you end up after, you know, the second Iraq, 2003 Iraq, with a recognition over time that this isn't conventional warfare where, you know, tank battalions can immediately gain victory. This is something different. It looks like an insurgency. And that happened in that phase from 2003 to 2005, 2006. And so I think when Nagel says this was new to the Pentagon in that time period, I think that, you know, as a broad matter, I think rings true.
Well, also
I do want to go back to a point you made, which is that the military learns and makes an effort to learn. And I think that's a hugely important point because my experience with them, both researching for the book and in other work that I've done, is they are very attentive, very active. And the most impressive thing about so many of the generals and others in the Pentagon and out in the field is that they're willing to say, I don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. I don't know everything. I want to learn. I want to bring in experts. Yeah. I want to try. And if something is failing, then maybe we should do something different about it. And not everyone's like that, of course, but by and large, there are a lot of good people who are really trying to make that effort and really trying to learn. And, you know, the Pentagon is, to take a weird metaphor, it's a big aircraft carrier, and it takes a long time to turn it if you're going to make change at a big level. But at the same time, there are people there who really do want to change. And I think that's an important part of even the little pockets of success stories along the way.
Yeah, my father spent some time at the War College, and I remember him calling me and saying how impressed – he's a hard, tough nut to crack. You remember him calling and saying how impressed he was with how intellectually vibrant – the discussions were among the military's top brass, generals and people like that. I mean, these guys were really, really engaged in the long debate, and he was really impressed. So it's encouraging to hear that.
What I was going to say, though, is I think it's always a question of what is the degree to which it's a learning organization, because in Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, part of the distinction that Nagel makes between the British and Malaya and the United States Army in Vietnam was that the British did a much, much better job of being a learning organization. And if you look at, for example, the IDF, right, the Israeli Defense Force, that's a deep, deep learning organization. And I think that if you look at the U.S. response in 2003 under Rumsfeld, where he banned the word counterinsurgency from being said, as Nagel said,
wow,
that's not a learning organization.
Yeah,
that's right. It's about it. There's certainly a difference in degree, and that's going to be the test. And I think that it gets at, you know, one of the big challenges that we have in modern warfare as a country, as the Pentagon, and that is that these conflicts are constantly changing. They're changing on the ground at the level of a village or a province. They're changing in the country, and they're changing around the world as a function of technology, globalization, illicit finance, and any number of other things, so that the wars of 10 or 15 years ago, the tools that you have in front of you, the mechanisms that people use are totally different from the ones that we have today. Now, totally maybe a little extreme, but you didn't have Twitter or social media or emails or electronic communications in the same way 30 years ago. Similarly, you don't have, you know, robotic technologies, satellite technologies used in the same ways 100 years ago as we have today. And I'm sure in 20 years, they'll be even further. And so those changes also are something we need to be attentive to. And that requires institutions like the military to become these learning institutions to a much greater degree, where there's flexibility, where there's adaptation, where there's creativity, and where there's willingness to hear dissent, alternative perspectives, and to try to learn from them.
Well, the good news is that it sounds like that is happening. I don't know to what degree, but here's what I've taken from Nagel and from you and from just it really taking a look at what happened in Iraq and all the Americans and all the Iraqis and all the Afghanis. But let's just take Iraq as an example, who have died and been wounded and all that stuff, this human tragedy. You know, it's not any better. Iraq, in many ways, is worse, you could make the argument. I don't want to get into that discussion, but nobody, I don't think, when Bush said the stakes are high, I don't think he was looking I think he would have been very hesitant to make the decisions he made if he had seen what is now Iraq. And I've taken away something over, you know, just the general thing I've taken away is the fact that you cannot shoot, bomb, stampede your way out of these problems and these wars. What I think has opened my eyes is I've realized that if you've got an insurgency, if you're fighting a war, let's take a war like Afghanistan, Iraq, I don't know, maybe even in the Congo and all these terrible places of conflict, you can't shoot your way out of the problem. There's got to be, you need guns, obviously, but you need maybe equally or even more, you need what's called soft power. You need to figure out a way to win hearts and minds, to get the fence sitters, as Tom Ricks calls it, the vast majority of people just wanting to live their lives and have a better life for their children. You've got to figure out a way to get those people on your side. You've got to figure out a way to create institutions that are viable. And that is not done with a gun. It's done with your brain. It's done with pens. It's done with imagination, and it's slow, laborious work. John Nagel's, you know, the title of his book, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, you know, that's what he says. When you're fighting an insurgency, it's a little bit like learning how to eat soup with a knife. It's slow, it's laborious, it's one step at a time. And that's kind of that. I hope that lesson, I hope, is being learned. I think the Israelis have got to be. I know a lot of them, I'm sure, are debating that. You've got a problem. You're not going to shoot your way out of it. You're not going to bomb a bunch of people and make it better.
I think not only are you right, but you know, you can write the next book on this topic.
Yeah, right. I'm so long-winded.
That's what sells books, right?
I know. It'll be called Wind by Brian Callen.
Academic book.
My book will be called Wind, or it'll just be called Brian Callen Parrots a Bunch of Other People Who Are Smarter Than He Is, Who've Done More Research, and He Does It With Humor. Anyway.
Well, but you know, if that is the book, one thing I think you can link this to is a big change in how these wars are different from the conventional way, the kind of mindset that we have about wars that we've inherited, especially from World War I, World War II. And that is that in those wars, we think that there is a clean break between war and peace. You have a war. The war is over, there's an armistice, maybe it's signed on a big ship or something like that, and then the next day there's peace. And you can do all the peace things afterwards, post-conflict reconstruction. It's called post-conflict reconstruction.
It's so funny you say that.
All of that. But one of the things I talk about in the book, one of the big themes, is that transitions from war to peace aren't a clean break in these kinds of conflicts. I call them turbulent transitions because they move in fits and starts. And so the question I think you ask is a good one. So should we interpret the Iraq war as over and as this is something new, or is this one continuous conflict since 2003? Similarly, what about Afghanistan? Should, you know, the Soviet invasion followed through conflict in the 80s, then pretty quickly thereafter the civil war in the early 90s, the Taliban took over, but there was still the Northern Alliance trying to resist them, then the overthrow of the Taliban onward to today. Is that one long 30-year war?
My God, I mean, listen, you could ask the same question. I always say the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you can't understand that conflict unless you go all the way back to, you know, Germany, 1933. I mean, what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany had a direct effect on what happened to the Palestinians in 2014. You've got to go all the way back. I mean, in many ways, you're right. These are conflicts that start a long time ago, and they take on different forms. I mean, they just morph into different kinds of conflicts.
And once you recognize that the conflict or that the kind of intellectual construct or the way we interpret these events isn't just an on-off switch, it isn't just war peace, it isn't just this particular thing right now, but that it operates in this backdrop of history and culture and all of these different factors, then your other point, which is you may not be able to win this thing just by guns and killing, is right, because if this operates in the context of history, culture, religion, clashes that are related to economics or ethnicity or any number of other factors, it may be that the only way to reduce the conflict is to solve those underlying things. And those underlying issues aren't ones that can necessarily be solved at the end of a bayonet. They have to be solved through writing, thinking, institution building, that kind of effort. And that is why, you know, counterinsurgency says that the main strategy is not killing and capturing the enemy. It's winning over the population.
Right.
And one of the points that you made in the pre-interview that we did, which I thought was excellent, is that there's this idea that because Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Taliban, that they don't follow international law, they do really whatever the heck we want, that we should be able to do whatever we want. That was the argument that some people in the Bush administration made. And your point is that, you know, whether that's true or not, it's just not smart strategy.
Yeah, so this is you know, when we think about the laws of war, one of the big debates, exactly as you said, after 9/11, is that the laws of war are premised on this idea of reciprocity, that the only reason we follow the laws of war is because the other side follows the laws of war too, and then it's mutually beneficial for both of us. And that's supposedly, according to one theory, the underlying theory of these laws. And the argument was, well, insurgents and terrorists don't follow the laws, so we don't have to either.
You heard that all the time.
And you heard it all the time. And you know, there are two responses to this. And the first response just says, no, it's humanitarian. Humanitarian goals are the underlying foundation, the bedrock of the laws of war. So whether or not they follow it, we have to do it for moral reasons. It's morally right for us to follow the laws. I think that approach, while I believe that to be right in part, it concedes way too much, because it concedes that there's no self-interested reason for us to follow the laws of war at all. And in fact, what counterinsurgency says is there's a strategic self-interested reason for us to follow the laws, and that is when we engage in operations where we are restrained, where we're thoughtful about the use of force, where we don't excessively kill civilians as a matter of collateral damage. When we operate in kind of an exemplary fashion, we will do better in winning over the population.
And we have gotten better at that, haven't we, in our efforts in at least Afghanistan? Would you say?
I think we have gotten better at it over time, and I think the military is trying to do better increasingly at it. And that is an important
thing. Because I think a lot of the military, they would agree
to push
with you
in that direction. Yeah, and I think we need to continue to push in that direction. I mean, you know, this is not. I'll give you an example of this. I mean, General McChrystal gave a speech once where he talked about what he called counterinsurgency math, and he said, assume you have 10 insurgents and you kill 2 of them. How many are going to be left?
8.
Because if you've killed a few people, they may have brothers or neighbors or siblings or cousins, and those people might be radicalized by your actions. Now, you know, this isn't some humanitarian saying it. This is General Stanley McChrystal, who was the commanding general in charge of the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, he was also a special. He was also a special forces guy. He's no pacifist. He's a rough dude.
Brian, did you do any missions with him?
I'm not at liberty to say, but me and McChrystal.
That's the point. Is even these guys who are special operations, you know, real tough people who've done their share of lethal force, are attentive to the sense that we have to be more careful, we have to be restrictive in some ways, and we have to be thoughtful about it, because if you overextend, if you go too far, you'll actually create a backlash that might be counterproductive.
If anything, a lot of these special forces guys, the guys who have actually
Green Berets and stuff,
they're the ones who are most attentive to
it's
it
so
because
true.
They actually understand what it's like.
Because they have to get involved in the actual populations. The Green Berets, the guys I've talked to, they spent time with the villagers. They ate their food. And you know what a lot of them said is they had a lot of the special forces guys I've talked to, which, you know, it's not a lot, but enough is, you know, they came out with a much deeper respect and an understanding that a lot of these people just wanted to be left alone, or just, you know, had the same essentially core needs that anybody does. And I always thought that was impressive. But I think the good news, and I correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, is that the military and the decision makers in the military would probably, for the most part, agree with you on what you're saying. I mean, don't you think that the debate, or at least the idea, these ideas we've been talking about, building institutions, fighting a counterinsurgency asymmetrically the way we're talking about without guns, has permeated and is now something most warriors who make decisions agree with?
Well, let me be optimistic and pessimistic. Okay. And I'll start with why I'm optimistic. So I'm optimistic because I think we have an entire generation of people who have gone to Iraq, who have gone to Afghanistan, who have fought in these wars, who understand this because they've lived it. And the future of the military, the future four-star generals, are going to be these people. Mm. And deep down, they understand it, they know it. And so as a matter of just generational change over the next 10 to 30 years, I think we're going to see the military, and I hope we're going to see the military be more attentive to these kinds of concerns that we've been talking about.
And then we'll be attacked by aliens, and it'll be a whole new war.
Whole different.
Like,
whole
damn it! What the hell? We learned all this stuff, and now aliens are here. Yeah.
but here's the part where I'm will be more cautious and maybe a little pessimistic. I think one of the questions we have to ask ourselves as a society, and particularly when we look to our political leaders, not just the ones who are in the Pentagon, but the people who are getting elected, who are going to be president or senators or secretaries of defense, have they fully internalized these lessons? And I think that is something that requires all of us to be more active, more vigilant, and to put and to keep questioning those folks, because I think in that debate, you know, it's not clear that the people have had as much exposure to these ideas or have really embraced that kind of thought process of being concerned about unintended consequences, about the counterproductivity of certain actions. And I think that conversation is one that, as a society, we always have to be mindful of, because particularly in light of you know, bad things happening, whether it's here or abroad, or threats that seem to emerge, everyone's instinct, mine, yours, I think everyone's, is going to immediately be to want to go do something. And we need to pause, reflect, and think about what are we going to do, what are the possible outcomes, what are the consequences. And I think most people would probably agree that one of the problems in the context of Iraq was, you know, not having thought enough about the planning for afterwards. And I think in all of these contexts, that's part of it. And so the question, the pessimism or the cautious optimism I would have is we're going to have to be vigilant to make sure that our political leaders have learned these lessons too.
But isn't the sad truth that to a certain extent, the foreign policy of our political leaders is frankly reflective of the foreign policy of most Americans? I mean, I know that you have to be diplomatic and say things like, have they fully internalized the lessons? But the reality is that while the Pentagon may have had a change of heart, the vast majority of the public still think it's about killing the bad guys.
So I guess that may be right. It may not. I'm not sure if there's polling on this. I don't know what the evidence is as to what the public thinks on killing the bad guys versus other things. But I think there are some pretty big differences in terms of public opinion versus Washington's opinion on a whole host of issues, foreign and domestic policy. And you know, you can go to Pew or other places to see polling. You know, I'll give you a domestic example. I think there's pretty good polling that the vast majority of people really love Social Security, want to keep it, and maybe even expand it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the conversation in Washington among leaders is about potentially cutting Social Security benefits. So that seems like a discrepancy. I think in foreign policy there are others. You know, to what extent should we intervene in foreign conflicts? And I think, you know, in some cases, maybe Syria last year was one of them. Maybe that's changed in public opinion now. I haven't seen recent polling on that. But there may be divergences between what the people believe generally and what people who work in policy or politics think. And so I guess I'm not fully committed to think that the American people haven't learned these lessons.
I think that's the thing, though. I think, again, you have to really, I mean, obviously there's huge disagreements between what the people actually want and what ends up happening in Washington. I mean, the majority of people would like gun control, but they're just not willing to fight for it as hard as the small percentage of the population that's in the NRA. But I think that we have to be really, really vigilant. I mean, I appreciate Brian trying to, you know, feel like we're getting better. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's also important for us to be really honest and self-critical, because it's so easy for us to, I mean, we had Vietnam and then we didn't do any real self-reflection. We just sort of limped along and the lesson was, let's not do that again. Mm-hmm. But without really thinking about what the lessons were or how should we be doing things differently.
Well, but that,
and
I
think, okay, the danger is that, yes, the American public doesn't necessarily want to get involved, but the swing that the United States has had since 1789 between isolationism and interventionism, and for a long time it was at isolationism, but that is very, very different from understanding that if you are going to get involved, then, you know, you have to minimize violence and try and win over the population. I don't know how much the U.S. public has learned hearts and minds, because I will tell you that just sort of watching the news and doing these things didn't convince me. It was only when I started reading the work of people like John Nagle and yourself, and I don't know how many people, sadly.
Well, I agree with you, Hunter, but I think that's also, you know, as you talk about swinging between isolationism and interventionism, I think Americans and people, and I certainly suffer from this, I don't know, I don't want to speak for, is there's this duality of thinking. This idea, I'm either Republican or Democrat.
Exactly.
Good guys, bad guys. Insurgents, counterinsurgents. And we do, it's very easy. Public school, private schools. Free market, government. And I do this all the time. you know, if you ask me, government should be treated like a necessary evil. I'm a libertarian, and I believe in hearts and minds, and I got 1,000 opinions, man. And if you listen to me, I am on one side. And the other side, I always have to fight the fact that I'm like, throw those ideas out the window. Those guys are dumb. Nah, that's the old. We got new ideas here. Human, very human. That's why if I were emperor, I would implement everything I've learned from this podcast. And I'm being serious. I'd go, well, I know exactly how to do this now. And I don't think anybody who's in power is any different.
Brian, here's the trick. And I think, Hunter, this is partly the response is, you know, we all have to be vigilant as much as we can. And I think part of that's education. Part of that is people listening to this podcast and others. But part of it is our leaders who do believe these things, whether it's in the military, whether it's people who are elected, need to actually show the leadership in pushing it. You can't sell wars like this on we're going to go and just win and then everything will be great. In part because you're setting up expectations for everyone to believe that that's what's going to happen, especially if you think that may not be the case. And while there's a tendency to want to be optimistic, part of leadership in this context is going to be telling people this might be a long conflict. It might be a long slog. We might have to spend many, many years, and that's going to be what it takes. And if you're, say, a senator or a member of Congress and you're voting to authorize force, the debate you should have is, are we really willing to authorize force for a long period of time? If not, we need to think clearly about that. And I think there are enough people out there who know enough that these are topics that can get on the agenda for public debate. And what it's going to take is hopefully leaders picking up on those things and trying to make them a key issue.
It's going to take leaders of genuine courage, because it's much easier to pander to the people and tell them, yep, this is going to be a quick war. We're going to win. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. But telling the truth is not currently very politically popular.
And I think the next war we get into is going to be something we have no choice in. I mean, the next war is going to be when you attack our towers and you know, you fly planes into those buildings. I don't think anybody at that time, including myself, wasn't into getting into Afghanistan and getting those assholes out of there. Sorry for the words, but that's how we were all talking. And I remember, you know, that's what happens is,
yeah, but this goes back to, you missed this one, but yeah. You know, this goes back to the whole problem. And this is actually, you know, this is what Nagel talks about, is that since World War II, we've wanted every war to be World War II. We talked about 9/11 as Pearl Harbor. We labeled the Axis of Evil.
Yeah.
And that was the wrong metaphor.
100%.
You know, the 100%. Last decade has been, you know, the result
we've
of
gotta
a
change
bad
our thinking.
Metaphor.
Right. We've got to change our thinking and how we approach the next conflict. That is the whole point. That's why, otherwise, you know, all the people that have perished in this war. Why did I use the word perish? What am I? Is this a Shakespearean? The people that have perished.
Brian, I think you're a romantic poet.
That's probably what it is.
That's a really nice cravat, by the way.
But I don't want. I just don't want. I don't want all these people to have died in vain. We better learn something. And it starts with this debate. It starts with talking about these things and being very honest about them. And like you said, Hunter, being vigilant about being critical, self-critical, not being afraid to say, I don't know if we've learned that much. You know, that's not a safe place to reside, because it's too relaxed. And I think you're right. I think the important thing is that, you know, you need to constantly be on guard with being too complacent or thinking that you have the answers.
Because I think for too long, we've been going with our gut. We went with our gut after 9/11. We reacted emotionally, and that was not a good decision.
Yeah.
Well, this is, you know, your point, Brian. I think just now, we can't think that we have all the answers. You know, humility is a great virtue for a reason, and this is something that I think we would be well advised to remember as we consider any conflict in the future, is being a little humble about what we know, what we don't know, what we can do, how we're going to be able to do it, and how much of the future we can actually predict.
Well, I think your book, The Counterinsurgents, Constitution, Law, and the Age of Small Wars, has done a service to that narrative. And your name is Ganesh Sitaraman.
See, People are learning, terrific. Brian. People are learning.
There it
Brian,
is.
Brian, you're a learning organization.
You're damn right I am. And you're a professor. And you, as I always say, this podcast, I don't always say it. I've been saying it lately because I like the way it sounds. We interview people that make a difference. And you are a leader of thought. And you are doing that, sir. And you are helping us with our next series of challenges. And I thank you for coming on the podcast. Keep doing what you're doing, young man.
Send a copy of this book to your lawmaker.
Yeah. Send a copy of this book to your lawmaker, actually.
Congressman, senator.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, we should actually...
The Counterinsurgents, Constitution, Law in the Age of Small Wars by Ganesh Sitaraman.
Actually, can we start a book drive for our elected leaders?
That's a good idea.
Like, I'd love
I'm going to tweet that, actually. Remind me to tweet that out, because I think I love that idea, and I'm going to do an Instagram video.
Yeah, let's send... We should come up with a list of 10 books that we think all elected officials should read.
That's actually a great idea, Hunter. Why don't we do that? All right, and I'll read them to them out loud on the floor.
Brian, are you going to do the audiobooks?
Yeah, and then Ganesh will be behind me to correct me when I pronounce his name Ganesh. God, the great god Ganesh has written a book, ladies and gentlemen. Who's the Hindu fundamentalist over here? It's ridiculous. My friend, you're a good man. Thank you. And if I'm doing stand-up down in are you in Nashville?
Nashville, Tennessee.
I love it down there, and I've performed down there twice. Next time I come down, I'll let you know. You got to come out. And
it's a great city. Everyone should come visit.
Love it there. I love it there. I had a great time there. All right, my friend. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep thinking. Keep writing. We need you. And that's all I have to say on the subject.
Thanks so much. This has been a lot of fun, and I'll hope to write another book so we can do this again.
I love it, man. You are always welcome back, even before you write a book. We love hearing your thoughts. Anytime you want to talk about something or something in the news, call us, man. We love this stuff. So
great.
All right. Thanks, Professor Ganesh Sitaraman. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen. You just learned everything! Hunter, ask me where I'm going now.
Where are you going?
Going to box.
Oh, Brian, really?
Yeah.
Now, has the counterinsurgency changed the way that you box?
No, it hasn't. Well, in fact, when you box, the one thing people think is that it's just about hitting mitts and hitting your opponent. You got to catch angles. You got to get out of the way. You can't stand in the pipe. You've got to hit and move off center. That's how it is. Bang, bang, move off center. Hit from off center. Step and hit. That's what you don't understand. You're constantly moving. Tennis and boxing are about footwork, about legwork. It's not about your arms. Your arms and your body, your punches, your swing, it's all very loose. It comes from your hips, your thighs, your calves, your feet, your lower body, bro.
Thank you for that lecture, yeah. Professor Callan. But let me ask you this. It sounds like it's a lot of it. Actually, it sounds like the majority of boxing is not about the violence. It's actually about the nonviolence, the avoiding the strikes. It's about learning.
Well, that's defense.
Yeah.
When you're trying to punch somebody in the face, it's very violent, my friend.
Absolutely. But the point is that, you know, it's like John Nagel said, right? Yeah. It's not about just sort of strafing. It's about knife fights. It's about surgical precision with your blows.
Accuracy is everything in boxing. You got to be able to place your shot where you need to.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, you've hit the nail on the head. When I fight, I compliment my opponent. And a lot of times in the clinch, I'll hug him and tell him that he's God's favorite. And then I break and then I sock him in the fucking jaw. Ladies and gentlemen, come see me do stand-up somewhere. Apparently,
where
I'm
can
hilarious.
We actually, wait a minute. Where can we come see you fight? That's what I really...
Box and Burn in Santa Monica with the great Wayne McCullough, who I'm going to have on this podcast. Grew up in Belfast, was a world
he's
champion
great.
Boxer, and one of my favorite people.
Brian, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You have, you have a choice between, you know, doing stand-up in front of, you know, 100,000, a million, or no, let's just make it simply, right? Wembley Arena in London.
Yeah.
You can either do stand-up there, or you can be in a boxing match there. Which would you want to be in? And it's a boxing match that you can actually win.
Am I a good boxer?
You're the boxer that you are currently. But it's against somebody that you could beat.
I mean, look, I have to say, without a doubt, and I love stand-up, the boxing match. Hunter, I don't like these personal questions.
Oh, okay.
I'll see you guys later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.